cut. Oh, you did that.
Hello, welcome to Cooking Issues Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues, here with Nastasha Lopez, Cooking Issues Hammer. And we are coming live to you every Tuesday from 12 to 12:45. Call in with all of your cooking-related questions. Our speciality is technical questions, but we will take any questions. Call in live to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. And today's show is brought to you by the Whole Foods Market and the Craft Beer Festival, which is coming up starting, I guess, Friday, right? It's a whole week of craft beer stuff. And to kick off the annual series, the Whole Foods Market Bowery is hosting a beer and food pairing event at their beer room. Oscar Blues is on tap, and Chef Jacques Gauthier of Park Slope's Palo Santo is cooking up one of his South American delights to accompany. The food tasting goes from 5 to 7, and the beer will continue till 9. With Craft Beer Week passports, get $3 off a 64-ounce growler fill. That's quite a lot of beer. And meet Chef Gauthier on Friday, September 24th, and enjoy some special tastes on tap from the kitchen. By the way, that's right by my house, actually. The Whole Foods Bowery is right by my house where I live in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And I was happy to see that very recently they have actually a homebrew section there. And I think it's the only place that I know of in Manhattan where you can walk in and buy malt and yeast and all the stuff for homebrewing. So cheers to you, Whole Foods, for making homebrew accessible to us Manhattanites. I haven't brewed beer since I was since right before my second son was born. And then my wife was like, hey, you know what? It's already a mess in the damn house. You got two kids. No more beer brewing. Because, of course, when I brew beer, like, I can't just be like a normal human being and use extracts. Like, you know, I have full, you know, full malt. You know, I ground it all in my house. It's a freaking mess. Delicious, but a freaking mess. Anyway, call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. So, Nastasha, it's been a busy week, right, for the Cooking Issues crew, which is why you haven't seen much on the blog recently, because we've been super busy. We're in the middle of Star Chefs Week, which you know, is a yearly convention of chefs, I guess. What do you think? Star Chefs?
Yes.
Anyway, at the Armory on the east side of Manhattan, and you know, a lot of the glitterati of the food world show up for 3 days and hang out, and we did a cocktail event yesterday, which was good. We have another cocktail event this afternoon, and
another one tomorrow.
Another one tomorrow. And then, coming up on Saturday, and there are, I think, believe only 20 tickets left, we are doing a cocktail for the Heritage Radio Network's yearly fundraising barbecue, the Heritage Radio Party, here at Roberta's Pizza in Brooklyn. And if you want to get one of those last remaining tickets, they're $100 a pop. You can email info@heritageradionetwork.com. That's info@heritageradionetwork.com. Okay, now, let's look for some questions. We have some email questions while we're waiting to see if we get any callers. Don Rollins writes in, and he said he just now listened to one of our previous shows, and there was a question we answered about vodka in sauces. And he says that Alton Brown mentioned, I suppose, Good Eats, right?
Yeah.
On his Good Eats show, that tomatoes contain several compounds that are soluble in alcohol, but not in water or oil, and that adding alcohol to a tomato sauce brings out more of its essential tomato-ness based on that fact. Well, Don, I did some research early this morning, and there are many, many references on the internet to that being the case, to there being an alcohol, like a certain principles in the tomato that are more soluble in alcohol. But I was not able to find any specific technical reference that bore that out. Now, it is true that alcohol is going to change the release, alcohol in your product is going to change the release of volatiles from it, and therefore change the you know, the flavor impact of the sauce. And I was able to find several technical references to that. There's also some mention on some sites of alcohol actually reacting with the tomato, you know, with the actual tomato to produce flavorful components that were not there before. So those are, you know, some possible things, but I don't have any ironclad evidence that I could find, you know, a scientific paper that said, hey, look, here's what's going on. I do, though, have a text into Harold McGee. So if he gets back to me on the question of tomato sauce and vodka and whether there's anything more complicated going on, I will relay it to you next week. Okay. Jake Andrews writes in to Nastasha and says he wants to know whether anyone... my iPad just died. No. He wants to know... he got taken on eBay with an older Polyscience Polytemp circulator that is missing the thermometer to control the bath. Is there anything he can do, or is he shafted? Well, I really, you know, I sympathize with you. I had my first kind of eBay shellacking recently, where I bought a piece of equipment, a refractometer actually, an automatic refractometer. The thing is, would be crazy awesome because it measures basically the refractive index of almost anything. It'll do bricks zero up to, you know, in the 90s automatically. Automatic temperature compensation. I could put a flow-through device on it so that I can measure things as I'm producing them, so I can measure alcohol content as I'm distilling. It has user-uploadable software profiles where I can upload. Anyway, it should be like a $5,000 piece of equipment. I bought it for $100 on eBay, and it said it was working, but guess what? It wasn't. And the company, I'm not going to mention Reichert by name, but they were not at all helpful to me. They wouldn't even help me troubleshoot. I think there's a problem with the EEPROM, which is the chip that, you know, loads the software into it, because hardware-wise, it seemed okay. But they wouldn't even, like, open their mouths to tell me, like, what to look at, so shellacked. Now, you're lucky in the one sense that PolyScience is not like this. I did a quick search on PolyTemp. I don't have the actual model. Oh, and for those of you that don't know what the hell we're talking about, immersion circulators are pieces of equipment that are becoming more and more common in kitchens today that very, very accurately control the temperature of liquid. They used to be lab equipment, but now they're basically used in kitchens for low-temperature cooking. And Philip Preston from PolyScience just released the first kitchen model a couple of months ago that's specifically designed for a kitchen. It's not just a piece of lab equipment. It's a piece of kitchen equipment. Anyway, they're great. I use it every day. It's the party machine. It's the brunch machine. Like, if you ever have a party or throw a brunch, this kind of equipment, you know, you should look into it. Anyway, you can see it on our website or go to polyscience.com. Anywho, Philip is not a huge fan of you going out and buying used equipment because he wants to sell new equipment, and also because he says he doesn't know what happened to the equipment back in the day. The other problem is I've worked on many of these eBay things that, you know, in the past 8 years, I've maybe had, or 10 years, I've had, 10, 12 ones off of eBay, and a lot of the older models break because they've been used in laboratories for a long, long time. The bearings tend to go bad on them. You tend to have corrosion on the internal contacts, which leads to resistance and overheating on the internal parts. So there are issues with the older ones. I'm assuming if it's older, it's analog. The good news is if you can get it to work, the analog ones are fairly accurate once you set them. You just need to get a separate thermocouple to monitor digitally what's going on. Now, the problem is that you don't have a temperature probe on it. Now, I did some research, and it appears that some of the older PolyScience circulators have what's called a thermocouple, basically, which is easy to source. The newer ones all use platinum RTDs, which also are not difficult to source or to wire. So what I would do is contact, either give me the model number or contact PolyScience directly and ask them what type of probe that unit has. And any one of those probes is very easy to source via eBay or McMaster Car. Not that you want to necessarily source on eBay again after you got shafted. But anyway, they're fairly easy to source. So you just need to find out exactly what it is that you need to get, and then make a determination as to whether or not it's worthwhile. First of all, you should fire it up, make sure the motor's still working, you know, make sure the electronics still come on. Anyway, I hope this helps. One of our people from our sous vide class last week, which is the reason why we, you know, couldn't be here live last week, Matt, wrote in, and he said he has a restaurant uptown in my old neighborhood, up 109th or 10th, 108th, called Sip. And check it out if you're up there. I haven't made it up there yet, but I intend to. So he's wondering whether we ever tried to carbonate liquor. Everyone who knows me personally knows that I carbonate nothing but liquor, basically. Liquor and water. I like everything with most everything I like with bubbles in it, right, Nastasha?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, bubbles. Burbujas. Anyway, I like bubbles a lot. So his question is, have we ever tried to carbonate in an old-fashioned soda water container? Because he wants to put it behind his bar because he thinks it's, you know, because they do look cool. It's not because he thinks they look cool. They do look cool. And he's actually going to make an infused liquor based on, like, a pepper and tomato, and he wants to carbonate it. Now, whether or not it's feasible to use these old bottles depends on what you mean by old bottle. So roughly you can divide into two different categories. One is the kind that take chargers on them, like CO2 chargers. And these are kind of the older variety home units, that glass with a metal cage around. EC made them, aka ISI, whatever you want to call them. A number of other manufacturers used to be made a lot in Czechoslovakia, very thick glasses. And these ones can be used to carbonate. The problem with them is that it's very hard to get a very good level of carbonation. First of all, liquor is going to require more CO2 than water, and it's hard to get the headspace out of the top of the unit. So what I recommend is if you're going to use one of those with two charge, you have to use two chargers. And what you do is make sure your liquor is super, super cold, right? Super cold. If you have a vacuum machine, deaerate it first to get rid of some of the air. If you don't worry about it, because you're going to go to the second step. You're going to put your liquor in. Make sure you always fill it to the exact same level every time. This way you know your recipe is going to work. Changing the level of liquid in the bottle is going to change the amount of carbonation you have each time, okay? So make sure it's just the same every time. Make sure the temperature of the liquid is the same every time, as cold as possible. Then put a CO2 cartridge in, swirl it to get it all dissolved, and then vent it so that it foams up, and so you lose. Turn it upside down so that the actual siphons, these old seltzer siphons, have a rod which goes down to the bottom so that when you press it, the pressure forces the liquid up through the rod and out the nozzle, right? When you're venting, you have to turn the seltzer siphon upside down so that you're venting the gas and not the product out. Otherwise, you're going to be in for a terrible mess. Anyway, so turn the thing upside down, vent out the gas. That's going to get rid of the air that's still trapped on the inside, and it's also going to get rid of a lot of what's called the nucleation sites, which cause excess bubbling, right? So that's the key step, turning it upside down and venting it. Then turn it right side up, put another charger into it, shake it, and chill it, and you should have a good product. Now, if you mean by old seltzer bottles the kind that the seltzer man delivers on a truck, or woman, I guess, but typically they were seltzer men, delivers on a truck, like Three Stooges style, and you have a little lever and you squeeze them and you spray your buddy in the face or put out a fire or whatever, no, that one is much more difficult to fill. They don't take a charger and they don't unscrew. Those are actually, the tops are left on them and they are washed and filled by a machine by actually... You squeeze the nozzle, like you squeeze the lever like you were going to spray seltzer out of it, and then a machine squeezes that nozzle and fills it without taking the top off. So I've considered for several years actually building something to do that, but I haven't done it, and it's not a trivial process. So I didn't see anyone on the internet. Until someone works out like a super slick do-it-yourself way of refilling those old seltzer bottles, I would not try to get one of those. Although it's always been a project that I've been interested in. It's just too many projects in too little time.
That's true. Right? I saw a lot at flea markets and I was going to get you one.
Yeah, well, also, if you're going to do it, get one with a metal mesh around it, because, you know, if someone nicks one of those old glasses and you're inflating it up to 60 PSI or so, I mean, those were built for 120 PSI, but who knows? You know what I mean? I don't want it to shatter and explode glass all over you, and then you say, man, Dave Arnold said it was okay to use it. Anyway,
that's not the,
yeah, okay. Oh, so we have a caller. Hello,
oh,
caller. How are you doing?
Hi, fine. How are you?
Doing well.
Okay, I have a question. It's about chicken, because I cook chicken thighs all the time, and it seems like no matter how I cook them, they come out wonderfully, and everyone thinks they're great. But whenever I cook chicken breasts or chicken cutlets or even a whole chicken, it just seems like the chicken breasts are never that tasty, and they're often dry, and especially the next day. Like, the next day, you can heat up a stew with chicken thighs, and it's really good and even better. But whenever I try to heat up chicken breasts the next day, they're even drier. So I just wondered if you have any tips.
Well, first of all, you are correct. Chicken thighs are inherently superior to chicken breasts. And I do not know what kind of marketing nonsense has convinced the majority of Americans that somehow white meat chicken is superior to dark meat chicken. It's insane. It's insanity. The thigh is inherently has more taste, possibly it's more fat and connective tissue. It's going to stay more moist and has a higher tolerance to overcooking than the breast meat does. I mean, that's just straight up fact.
Okay.
Breast meat in like a typical American chicken doesn't have as much flavor as you'd like. But, you know, here are some things. I mean, do you brine the breasts?
No, but that's a good thought.
Yeah, here's the thing. So when you brine the breast, two things are happening. Or I brine both. But if you brine the breast with even you could just do water solution till it's salty, tasty like salty, almost like ocean salty, and then you add sugar until it just gets sweet. And what you're doing is by adding that salt, you are changing the amount of water that the muscle can hold on to, right? So it seems counterintuitive because when you add salt, usually you're drawing moisture out. But
right.
when the salt gets into the meat, it's actually changing the amount of moisture that the meat can hold on to when it cooks. And it gives you a couple extra degrees of temperature before the meat dries out. And it'll also appear moister when it's cooled down. The other, you know, obviously, you want to be careful not to overcook the breast. If you cook the breast separately from the thigh, it's easier. But That the main thing is the brining. Also, the brining is going to increase the salt level on the inside of the meat, which is going to increase the flavor of that meat, make it a little less inherently flavorless, you know?
Okay.
So you win two times with that. You know, if you have an immersion circulator, that is a spot-on way to you know, the piece of equipment we were just talking about, it's a spot-on way to cook it, because then you can cook a chicken breast to like 63, 64 Celsius, and when it cools down, it's super juicy and the texture is just right. But I personally think it's hard to, you know, using traditional cooking techniques to achieve a good chicken breast that's good as a cold preparation the next day. You know, that's why we tend to chop it up and toss it with mayonnaise. Do you know what
okay.
I mean?
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. That's what I always do.
Yeah, I mean, that's delicious too. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I love chicken salad. I mean, you know, we grew up on that stuff. I love chicken salad, but. So I don't know whether I've been helpful.
You probably make it with homemade mayonnaise, right?
You know, I wish I could say that's true, but there's certain things that you grow up with in life, and you just tend to like them. And one of them is I like store-bought mayonnaise. I hate to say it. I just
really do too, actually.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's just.
Well, what about poaching chicken breasts? I mean, that's sort of something we all grew up with too.
Right. Well, poaching chicken breasts. You know, there's a couple of I used to do it quite a lot. You know, Jacques Pepin came out with a cookbook in the 80s, and he has a chicken salad recipe, poached chicken recipe, that he attributes to Danny Kaye, the famous actor, was also, I believe, mm-hmm. a conductor and a fine, fine cook. He used a technique where he would put it into water, although I would use broth, right? And then you can raise the temperature till it just comes to the boil, and then you cover it, and then you let the heat ride out. Now, it's no way an accurate cooking technique, but it's a variation on a cooking technique that has been used for millennia. For instance, hams used to be cooked that way in a 5-gallon lard container. You would heat the water up in the lard, put the ham in, close it, and then wrap it up and let the carryover heat. And the theory is that the carryover heat's going to be enough to cook it, but the temperature is going to drop enough that it's not going to horribly overcook the meat by the time it's done. So I used to fill up a pot of water and put, you know, a pot with some, you know, vegetables and, you know, if you had some broth or stock, you could put it in. And then chicken breasts, I would also use thighs, bring it up to the simmer, close it and let it ride out. And you get two things. You get a nice broth and you get some nice chicken meat that's good for a cold salad because it was not overcooked, but cooked in water. So it didn't lose or cooked in moisture. So it didn't lose a lot of it's not dry. So, and that's, you know, attributable to Danny Kaye through Jacques Pepin, if that's helpful.
Well, that's really helpful. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for listening.
Okay, take care. All right, bye.
You should take a break, Dave.
Oh, and I'm told that we are coming on to our first commercial break. This is Cooking Issues, Cooking Issues Radio on Heritage Radio Network. 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Welcome back to Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network, where we answer your cooking questions at 718-497-2128. 718-497-2128. Okay, so Michael Griffiths from Philadelphia is a follower of the blog. Thank you so much. And he called in because he is having a problem with some seafood sausages he's making because they added ginger to them. And he says they didn't come out the same. And he's pretty sure that the ginger reacted, he thinks, with the eggs and messed it up. He said because he also has put ginger into consomme, and you couldn't get the raft. When you're clarifying things, you traditionally add an egg white raft, and the protein along with whatever ground up lean meat you put in helps hold on to the turbidity, and helps clarify the stock over time. The proteins are charged, and they actually hold on to the stuff that's making it cloudy. And he's saying he thinks it's the ginger that's messing it up, and what the hell's going on now? I don't actually know that it's the egg white specifically that's having a problem with the ginger. It might actually be the meat and the binding of the muscle proteins together, because ginger, it's a well-known enzyme in ginger is... there's a protease enzyme in it, and I believe the name of it, although I could be wrong, is zingibane, and that's a protease enzyme. It's going to break things down, and it's used as a meat tenderizer. And in fact, it's just as effective, if not more effective, than papain and all these other commercial meat tenderizers. So ginger juice is has been a well-known tenderizer. I believe since antiquity. So, it does contain protease enzymes, and that's going to mess up your raft and might also mess up your sausage. You could cook the ginger, but then beforehand that would wipe out the enzyme, but might change the flavor of the ginger. But these things are being cooked anyway. So if you pre-cook the ginger, you're not going to have a problem. An interesting recipe to look up that has to do with ginger and proteins is a Chinese dessert called a ginger milk curd, where they take a milk and they add ginger, and it causes it to curdle and set. So this is a well-known and interesting fact. Thanks for calling our attention to it. And another interesting thing I was looking up the technical literature on ginger enzymes, and ginger enzymes, zingibane or whatever it's called, is very effective specifically at collagen, at breaking down connective tissue, it seems to have a higher affinity for that than other protease meat tenderizing enzymes do. So thank you for that question. And he also had a question about lobsters, because he heard that lobsters that are in tanks start to feed off their own flesh, which is true, because they typically don't feed lobsters in tanks, because if you feed a lobster in a tank, it's going to raise the waste products that are in the tank, and any feed that's not used up is going to cause problems. So they tend not to feed. I guess also it might cause aggression problems, but I don't remember. It's been a long time since I've read that kind of technical literature on lobsters, but that is true. But they can survive a very, very, very long time. So I don't know how much flesh degradation there is just from being stored on a tank, although it's something I've heard quite a bit. The next time I speak to a lobster scientist, I will definitely ask them that question. The second thing is, what is the enzyme that breaks down lobster meat after you kill them, and how long till the enzyme starts to work, et cetera, et cetera? Can you prevent that enzyme from working by freezing it? Now listen, this is an incredibly complicated question, because there's very, very, very many enzymes on the inside of a lobster. Lobster tends to have a breakdown of its tissue relatively quickly, because the circulatory system and basically all the guts of the lobster, everything's in close proximity and kind of an open system. So once the animal is dead, those enzymes really start to work quickly. There's a number of enzymes. It's not just one enzyme that goes to work in lobsters. There's enzymes in it that break down ATP and other nucleotides, and they eventually become products that affect flavor. In fact, IMP, inosine monophosphate, is reduced to changed to other things that have a negative impact on quality, and that is easily traced and is used as an indicator of quality, because as that starts to progress, other things like proteolytic enzymes have also been working, breaking down the meat. So. And it's very well known that I forget what the thing is called, the organ on the inside of the lobster, it's something like hepatopancreas or something like that, contains a variety of protease enzymes that are just going to wreak havoc with the meat. Now here's the bad news. you cannot stop those enzymes by freezing, because as you thaw the meat out, like freezing it, they will work somewhat as they're frozen, because unless it, there's something called the eutectic point, where when you freeze a something below the point at which there's no water left at all, then yes, enzymatic activity stops. But in fact, what happens is that at normal freezer temperatures, there's still a good bit of unfrozen water left inside of your tissue, and enzymes can continue to work in that situation. But real hell breaks loose when you thaw it, because then you have a lot of water that becomes available to these enzymes that are in a hyper-concentrated state in the remaining tissue of the animal, and they just go to town. And so you end up having huge degradation on thawing, especially if things are, apparently, if things are rapidly thawed. So I hope this answers your question. I plan on doing a lot more work with lobsters soon. I've been, for literally for a year and a half, I've been supposed to be pitching something to the New York Times on lobsters and what we do with them. So look for more in the somewhat near future, although I don't know. Nastasha, how near future do you think, realistically? What are we talking?
3 years out.
Oh, Jesus, come on now. That's not right. Okay, anyway. another interesting thing. Not only are the enzymes working more, but I found a study that says that the muscle fibers of lobster are something like four times more liable to breaking by proteolytic enzymes than like mammal tissue. The one they used was rabbit. They said that the lobster meat was broken down four times easier than rabbit meat. And I only saw one paper in passing this morning, but anyway. And also, cool thing, there's a paper called Novel Uses of Fish and Marine Invertebrate Enzymes in Food Industry from 2000. And they have a cool thing that, and it's because of this question that I looked it up. They have a cool technique where they use enzymes to descale fish, so the scales can basically just be washed off, and then the skin is perfect. You don't have any problem with knife marks or scraping in the skin. And it's used because people tan fish skins for leather, and those guys don't want any scraping on their skin, and so the enzymatic. But I wonder whether there's any application for food industry. What do you think? Fun?
Maybe.
Look it up.
Fun.
Yeah. Marine pepsin. The one I found came from salmon. Anyway, Sue, thank you for that question. And now, our former favorite Thai intern, of course, our only Thai intern, we do love him, Weepop, Weepop Soupy Pot, asked about the old cucumber trick of rubbing cucumber ends together to get the bitterness out. So for those of you that aren't aware, there's an old kind of, what do you want to call it? Like a kitchen, what do you want to call it? Old piece of kitchen wisdom?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Because I hate that term, old wives' tale.
Yeah, I know.
I hate it. What does that mean?
Nothing.
First of all, is it old wives or old wives? Wives?
Old wives. Wives. It's pretty misogynistic.
Wives?
Sure?
Yes, I'm sure. Yeah, okay. Anyway, so if it was old wives' tale,
maybe
then
it's old wife's.
What? That's crazy.
I don't know.
Anyway, so anyway, there is an old piece of kitchen wisdom, or maybe not wisdom, that if you... take and cut the end of a cucumber off, and then the both ends of the cucumber, flip it and rub the other end with the other end, then all of a sudden the bitterness is going to go away. Now, for those of you out there that are like, hey, cucumbers aren't bitter, what the hell is he talking about, right? Now listen, there are wild cucumbers are bitter. Pickling cucumbers can be bitter. Most supermarket cucumbers, in fact, are not bitter. And if they are bitter, it's the skin that's bitter. Right? So a very, very small percentage of supermarket cucumbers are bitter. And certain people can't even taste the bitterness even in the cucumbers that are bitter. What's making it bitter and is a thing called I will never be able to pronounce this. Cucurbitacin B and C, and these are present in all the cucumber plants, but usually not so much in the actual fruit. And if they are in the fruit, they predominate at the stem end. So if you cut the stem end off and then peel it, you're going to get rid of most of the bitter. But I have not found any sort of evidence for rubbing it getting rid of that bitterness, and it doesn't make any sense. If you're cutting the ends off of the cucumber, well then hell, you're getting rid of the most bitter part of the cucumber, especially if you peel it. So that's going to help right there. The rubbing looks like it's doing something because it foams up and forms a slime. But if you think about it, and I'm willing to be proven wrong on this, how the heck is you going to pull bitterness out of a whole cucumber just by rubbing the end? I mean, I could stick the end of a cucumber in a pot of stink for like, you know, half an hour and then cut the stink off and the rest of the cucumber is still fine. So how are you going to draw the bitterness out just by rubbing the end? True or false, Stassi?
True.
She looks upset now. She's never going to eat a cucumber again. So if you have a bitter cucumber, the bad news is that even on the same plant, some cucumbers will be bitter and some won't. And you know, no one's exactly sure. It's like the stress of growing, like how old they are. But your best bet is to cut off the ends and peel it and then wash it to get rid of the bitterness and you're going to be okay. Oh, we have a caller. Hello, caller.
Hey, hello. How are you?
Doing well.
I had a question. I've been making a drink for a few years now. It's espresso and Coca-Cola, and I just put it over ice. I played around with it a bunch. But the main thing is, the way I do it is I take ice, put a drop of espresso over the ice, and I put Coca-Cola, Diet Coke, okay, it doesn't matter. Uh-huh. What happens is the Coca-Cola foam stiffens up a lot. I want to know if you know... Why that would be?
All right, Jose, I'm having a lot of trouble hearing you because your cell phone's breaking up on me. I heard what I was able to hear was espresso beverage and foam. But what do you say? Do you put cocoa in it?
Right. I make a beverage with espresso and Coca-Cola.
Oh, Coca-Cola and espresso. Okay. And the problem with the foam is what?
Foam thickens up a lot. I wanted to know if you know why that would be.
Yeah. So. If you've ever carbonated coffee before, it's a nightmare in terms of foaming. It really foams up a lot, like a lot. And I've never done the research on why, but there's a, you know, coffee has a lot of, espresso specifically has a lot of body to it and a lot of emulsified oils in it. And it has a high total dissolved solids content. And it's known for holding a head, like a good espresso, right, has a crema on it. So when you dump an espresso into a Coca-Cola and then try to uncap it, you're going to get like a serious head formation. I've had, when I carbonate coffee beverages, I usually carbonate with nitrous. It's not carbonating, but I carbonate with nitrous to add the creaminess back to the coffee beverage. Like when I'm doing cold, like espresso-based cocktails, and they foam like the dickens. You just can't. You can't get around it. I should have done more research.
I think it's
maybe
delicious, honestly. It's my favorite part of the drink.
Yeah, if you're pouring it in, but when you're doing it in a bottle under pressure, it's hard to not have it spray all over the kitchen. It is delicious. I mean, you should try. You know, if you like that, do you have one of those ISI cream whippers where you are?
I don't have one. No, I've used them in the past in a lot of restaurants I've worked in. I'm planning on getting one for the restaurant I'm starting with now.
Yeah. So just for giggles. When you're not doing a Coca-Cola one, when you're doing a regular one, just try hitting a cold espresso beverage with a shot of nitrous, and you get a lot of that body and creaminess back that you get from a fresh shot, even more so, but it doesn't have the carbonation taste. So the carbonation taste, like there's a Manhattan soda, called Manhattan soda, I think, that's really good, that is a carbonated coffee drink. But a lot of people, if they don't, they want that creaminess without the, and that foaminess without the carbonation, you could try nitrous, and that I've had good success with that.
All right. Great.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for calling in.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Let me see here. We got some more questions on the email. Okay. So Anthony Wong, who took our sous vide class, wrote in and said, I mentioned that I use stainless steel pins for cooking a duck breast instead of scoring the skin. Now, he wants to know where he can get it and what kind. A word of background here. When you're cooking a duck breast, you want to cut. Most people will tell you want to score the duck breast. The skin side of it, so that when you render out the skin, when you crisp up the skin, the fat's going to render out. Now, Nils Noren, my buddy, partner in crime, head of the French culinary department, detests this practice because he says that where the scoring is, you're going to overcook the meat. But people who are pro scoring say, well, they want more fat rendered out. So where do you come down on this? Well, Chris Young, chef, formerly the research chef at the Fat Duck Restaurant in England, and Nathan Myhrvold, the Microsoft billionaire inventor of PowerPoint and many other things, are coming out with I've seen it. It's really good. The greatest tech cookbook ever written. It's a huge magnum opus. It's coming out at the end of the year. They demonstrated a technique last year at Star Chefs where they said, well, what if you took a dog brush? And, it's like a steel dog brush. You just go to a pet store, make sure you get one that's stainless steel, and it's got zillions of little tiny stainless steel spines on it. And you just smack the duck breast with this dog brush a couple times, and it makes all these micro perforations in the skin, and they allow the fat to render out of the duck breast without giving you enough area to overcook the meat that's underneath. And you know what? We've tested it several times, and it's a fantastic idea. So I think anyone that cooks duck breast on a regular basis needs to go buy a dog brush. Please don't use the brush you've already used on your dog. That's gross. Go get a brand new dog brush. I think they're like $3 or $4. You can get them at any pet food store, pet store, or pet supply mart, right? And they do wonders. So
break time.
All right. I've been told we're going to our next commercial break. So call your questions into 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Cooking issues.
All right. If you want to get down with a bun, this is the way you do it. Walk up and rap to it. Put your hand on the lower left arm.
Come on now.
You know? Yeah. And this is what you rap to. I mean, come on like you should. Come on with you. Come on.
Welcome back to Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. And we have a caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Dave. How are you?
Hey.
I had a question about steak.
Oh, good. I like steak.
I'm a big fan of steak, especially ribeyes and grass-fed ribeyes.
Nice.
But sometimes when I cook the steak, there's this really hard tendon that runs through it, and I'm not sure what the reason for that is or what to do with those.
The silver skin or the actual piece of connective tissue that is that one little section on the upper part of the muscle that's in one part of it but not the other? There's not a lot you can do about that. As far as I know, you have to kind of cut it out. I tend to trim it. I mean, one thing you can do, you can see it before you cook it, right? And you can trim that out. And then and then re-glue it back together with transglutaminase. I can't remember what that's made out of. I mean, I don't think that's going to render even under long cook. I could be wrong. I don't remember whether that does. But, of course, you're never going to cook that kind of meat long enough to render it. So I don't think, short of removing it and gluing it back together, which I have done many times, I don't know of a good way to get that done. Do you have access to meat glue?
No, I don't, but I do have a circulator.
Okay. Yeah, what the problem is this. So, so for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, in certain cuts of steak, as you go along the rib steak, you'll see that there's certain ones that have these little like dots in between the two muscle parts that are, they can stay hard basically. There's an enzyme called transglutaminase, Activa transglutaminase, that will glue proteins together, and it's very simple to use. The problem is you have to buy a whole bag of it, and I have a question on that. It actually came in on an email. I'm going to answer in a minute. But that can rebond the meat together, and I use it for taking out pieces of connective tissue and then gluing meat back together. And that's viable, but you know, you have to have that stuff lying around. The problem with circulators with that is that to render a piece, if it was connective tissue, which is going to get soft with long cooking, and I don't know that that's the case, at the temperatures you're going to want to cook a ribeye, which is roughly 55 degrees Celsius, it would take several days to really break it down. And you know, in the tests that we've done with ribeyes, you don't want to cook them more than about 6 hours. We've done 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours, 8 hours, 9 hours, 10 hours, and overnight on ribeyes. And we like them best in the ribeyes, that is, in the 2 to 4 hour range. And we like them okay, you know, up to about six. At eight, we feel that they're, you know, starting to take on kind of a little bit of a squashy texture, and that gets fibery as you chew. And that long, long cooking on ribeye is not going to be necessarily so good for it. So I don't know that you have a long cooking way of getting at it. Hey, you know, you could do, if you don't have meat glue, though, you could still cut out that portion that you don't like, and then basically almost, I don't know if this is going to work. You could try dusting it. I don't think gelatin's going to hold it together at the high temperature. I'm trying to think of something you can use other than meat glue, because all you really want to have to do is bind it together. Do you have a vacuum sealer as well?
Yeah, I do.
I mean, you could try sprinkling a little bit of salt and then some sort of gelatin. It's going to melt when you do it, but if you vacuum it together, it's going to hold together while you cook it, and it'll probably hold together while you sear it. But then as you cut it on the plate, obviously you're going to see that you've trimmed out a piece of the muscle, you know?
Right.
Sorry, I couldn't be more helpful on this one.
No, it just sounds like I have to get some transglue mix.
Yeah, you definitely do. You definitely do. Thanks for calling in. That leads great into our next question from Matt, who says he's been reading up on transglutaminase after seeing the Iron Chef episode where my brother-in-law, Wiley Dufresne, used it to make, unfortunately, not shrimp noodles, tilapia noodles. Tilapia is, you know, not our favorite fish. Anyway, he said that he really wants to start using it, but he has a couple questions. Do you know of a supplier who sells quantities smaller than the $90 bags online, which are 1 kilo, either an online supplier or a brick-and-mortar store in Boston or New York? And the short answer is no, I do not. It used to be that, and it might still be for all I know, that if you call up Ajinomoto, the company that makes it, it's Ajinomoto makes transglutaminase enzyme, which is meat glue, the stuff that glues proteins together. You sprinkle it on like powdered sugar and the meat just sticks together. It's great stuff. They make it, Ajinomoto under Aji Foods USA makes it, and the brand name they use is Activa, and the one that you want to get to start with is Activa RM. They used to give out like small 200 gram, I think, sample packs to chefs, but the chef community has taken to it so much, they might no longer give out sample packs. And unfortunately, Ajinomoto does not sell increments smaller than 1 kilo. And because they come packed direct from Ajinomoto in 1 kilo packs, and not in like 50-pound sacks the way that like, you know, most powders and hydrocolloids come, companies haven't been willing to break them down into smaller packs, and Ajinomoto hasn't been willing to make available to pay for their sample packs. Now, if Ajinomoto just said, hey, look, we're going to quadruple the amount of sample packs we're going to make, and then just charge three times as much per pound, people would still buy it, because people would rather, to test, spend $15 on 200 grams or $20 on 200 grams than shelling out for a whole kilo if they don't know if they're going to use it over time. Especially, you know, they figure they're not going to use it before it goes bad. We have toyed with the idea at Cooking Issues of making that enzyme available the same way we make Pectinex Ultra SPL and Pectinex Smash, the miracle pectin breaking down enzymes that make the world's greatest french fry and the world's greatest juices. But we decided against it because we didn't know that we wanted to get in the business of cutting open that retail pack and then repacking it and selling it. Maybe we should. I don't know. It's something
I think we should.
Yeah, but, I mean, yeah. I have to figure out whether or not it's a problem to do it, or whether or not, you know, we're going to run into any issues with it. But you know, it would be useful to people. So I apologize that there is no way. But here's what you should do. You should get together with some buddies. You should split a package of it, and then when you buy it, make sure that you cut it open. You instantly get all the air out and store it in the freezer, and it will last a good long time in the freezer, like six, 8 months in the freezer. And you'll get good good use out of it. So, I mean, it's definitely worth getting if you can split the bag with, like, you know, four or five people, even more so. But anyway, I'm sorry I couldn't be more help with that. But then the second part of the question is, can meat glue be used with non-meat proteins? And can you do something interesting with nuts, for example? Well, I've never done anything with nuts, but it does make tofu firmer. And, you know, you can make, for instance, peanut tofu, but peanut tofu is very, very soft, and it's very hard to get to hold together. So perhaps you could use, and this is perhaps because I've never done it, perhaps you could use transglutaminase to help cross-link proteins in, like, a peanut curd, for example, and then make a more effective peanut tofu. Because peanut tofu is a real pain in the butt. It really clogs things up. It's hard to get it to set up nicely. It's delicious when you get it right, though, so that's possible. So yeah, transglutaminase works on any protein like that. Works, like I said, I haven't tried nuts, but it works on cheese. You can glue things to cheese. Works on egg yolk. It thickens up egg yolk quite nicely, and you can glue things to egg yolks. We glue bacon to egg yolks, which is meat, but you could glue cheese to an egg yolk, I guess. You know, any protein like that. I mean, the problem with slurry is if there's not enough protein and there's too much fat, like in a nut paste, then the protein doesn't have anything to bind onto, and it makes for very kind of weak bonds. And so in certain situations, it tends to act more as a thickener than as a gluing agent. They also have one for dairy that's used for yogurt to make yogurt set up better, but is used by, you know, like Johnny Ozzini to make ricotta dumplings or gnocchi rather. So yes, it will bond anyone, or it will be active on any one of those on any one of those proteins. There's a lot of things yet to be done with it. Wiley, my brother-in-law Wiley Dufresne, he has a very, very interesting application. Unfortunately, it's meat because it uses gelatin, but basically he uses transglutaminase to cross-link gelatin so that it doesn't melt anymore, and he makes sheets out of vegetables like pasta, and then lets it set overnight with the transglutaminase, and it, once the gelatin sets up and cross-links, it no longer melts but stays flexible like a noodle, and these things can be fried into crisps or used as pasta. It's a fantastic technique. You can look for it on the internet. That one, you want to use the Activa. There's a special one called TI that's just the enzyme. It doesn't have most of the ones we use have casein or added gelatin in it. You want to make sure you use the one that's just straight enzyme for that technique. But hopefully that's helpful, and I wish you luck in your transglutaminase journeys. I have another question from Ray in D.C., Hi, Ray. And he likes our show, which is nice. Thank you. A friend of his went to a place called PX in Alexandria, Virginia. And he said they had a drink that was made with tobacco. Tobacco in the drink. Tobacco infused. And he thinks it's made with bourbon. Well, that place, PX, is the guy there is a guy named Todd Thrasher. And for a number of years now, I think three or four, he's been well known for infusing cocktails with tobacco. And I forget, I saw him interviewed on it once, and it was something about like his childhood memories. I think he grew up maybe near a tobacco farm. Anyway, like, it has a lot of childhood memories for him, the smell of tobacco. I believe he does not infuse the tobacco into the bourbon. He infuses it into, I believe, water, and then adds the tobacco water as a syrup to the bourbon. That's, I think, how he does it. But I'm not sure because I don't think he publishes his recipe. Now, the second part of that question was, what do you think about the health effects of that? Well, it's definitely probably, you know, ingesting it that way is definitely, you know, less harmful than smoking it because, you know, a lot of the harmful products in tobacco come from combustion of tobacco. But it's not risk-free, obviously. You know, I don't know what the long-term effects of ingestion are. You know, but nicotine by itself has, you know, effects on your cardiovascular system. You know, if you ingested huge amounts of it, for any of you who have ever tried dipping tobacco, you know, like, you know, the stuff you dip that you put in your lip and have accidentally swallowed the juices, you know that concentrated tobacco juices, you know, make you throw up like a demon. At least they make me throw up like a demon. Apparently, if you dip all day, every day, you can start swallowing the juices without spitting and not vomit. But the one time I was in my buddy Charlie's room when I was in high school, and he gave me some dip, and then he said, "Why aren't you spitting?" And I said, "You need to spit." And 30 seconds later, his entire room was coated with my lunch. Like, you know, from that on in, I was like, large concentrations of tobacco juice don't sit well, literally, in your stomach. And so, you know, I doubt he's putting enough tobacco in to have that kind of effect, which means he's probably putting a very small amount in, which means any health effect is probably small, you know, especially because how many are you drinking? I don't know. What do you think, Stasi?
I don't like tobacco.
No. All right. Wait. So I hope that answers your question. And Ray also says that he's been infusing vodka using our infusion technique, and we appreciate it. Thank you for your question. Now, Curtis wrote in and he said, regarding freezing and enzymes, because we were talking about that earlier, this is like live email, it's crazy. I have found that pork tenderloin is much more tender when frozen than thawed as compared with fresh. Well, I haven't done the test myself, but that's entirely possible. If you slow freeze a piece of meat, what happens is as you're freezing it, water is drawn out of the tissue and forms ice crystals. The slower that it's frozen, the bigger the ice crystals are, and they can have a tendency to not only puncture the meat cells so that when you thaw you get loss, but also those big ones are harder to reabsorb back into the meat tissue as it thaws. So when you're freezing something, think of it as a partial dehydration, and when you're thawing it, the meat is reabsorbing that liquid. Now, the more something drips liquid when it's thawed, the more damage you've done to the meat. Now, that damage, though, it's possible, I haven't studied it, but it's possible that that actually could make it more tender as long as you're not cooking it to the point where it's going to dry out again. So it's entirely possible, as you say in your question, that the proteolytic enzymes present in the meat kick into overdrive as they're thawed. But I don't know that information off the top of my head. I'm going to have to do some research. So Stasi, if you want to rejot this question down. Mm-hmm. I'll try and look for freeze thaw tenderizing in the scientific literature over the course of the week, because it's an interesting question. I hadn't thought of it, but it's probably, you know, the effect, which again I haven't tested, is probably a multifactorial thingamajig. Mm-hmm. Right. Anywho, all right, so we were trying to call our good buddy Mark Ladner for this next question. Mark Ladner is a chef at Del Posto and a tall man. How tall is Mark Ladner? I think 6'4"?
6'10".
6'10". Crazy. He's like 6'4", 6'5". So he's tall. He's tall. Anyway, this will make sense in the next question. So Steve writes in and said a friend whose name is Colleen, right, mm-hmm. is a tall woman. She is 6'7".
It's tall.
Yeah, just under 6'7", actually. 6'6", short. Yeah, not even 6'7". No. So she's basically 6'7". She loves to cook, but she gets terrible back pains when working in the kitchen, particularly when preparing food. And so they have a the standard countertops are 36 inches high and is, you know, inadequate for her. They did some calculations, and they figured that the average countertop is built for someone who's 5'4 to 5'5". I think it's based on kind of the average World War II era housewife. Jeez. So they constructed a butcher block that's 13 and a half inches high, you know, a table that fits on top of the countertop that she can do her cutting on. And she loves it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look on the internets. There's pictures of her using it, and she enjoys it. But she's enrolling in a culinary school, and the question is, what can be done for a very tall cook? Does she have to bend over, or can she bring something like her modified butcher block with her to school, or are there other approaches? Well, that's an interesting question. First of all, I don't know that 6'5", 6'4", is actually... I'm sure you've read the studies. I haven't. I'm 5'10", and I like countertop heights a lot. When they're even like a couple inches taller, like let's say like they were 5 inches taller for me, I get fatigued because of the way that I'm used to cooking. So a lot of what's happening with your back and working at a countertop has to do with how you position yourself at the counter, like what your stance is and where your wrist and your arm is. So I'm used to working at 36. So when you go lower or you go higher, like I get totally messed up. Right. Mm-hmm. But that's because I'm used to that. Now, I stood on a stool that made me as tall as Colleen, right? And indeed, my arms, I could not get a comfortable stance no matter how I tried. Now, of course, I'm sure Colleen's arms are longer than mine. You know what I mean? I mean, so I don't know whether it's 100%, accurate, but I can see the definite need for someone that height to increase the height of their countertop. Now, here's the problem. If you're going to a cooking school, I think what you're going to do depends entirely on why you're going to cooking school and what kind of cooking school you're going to. If you, I had this discussion, my wife's an architect, and I was having this discussion with her last night after this question came in. Well, For instance, would a workplace be required to allow you to bring something in because of your height? Could you, for instance, go in, and I'm not saying being tall is a disability, you know, I wish I was tall, you know what I mean? But like, in other words, we have, in the U.S., we have the American with Disabilities Act, and you have to make the workplace, with the exception of a couple jobs like airline, you know, a flight attendant and whatnot, safety jobs like that, you have to make the workplace accessible to anyone based on something that's classified as a disability. But I don't know that you would classify being too tall for the countertops as something that a workplace would necessarily have to make compensation for. But I don't know. It's a very interesting question. Now, if you're going to cooking school and you're not interested in working in a pro kitchen, you know, for years and years, then by all means, I would say, you know, ask them, let you bring it in and use it. You know, there's no reason to break your back. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be working in professional kitchens for, you know, a long, long time, you know, I would recommend at least trying to figure out some way to modify your stance, or modify something, or maybe use like a weightlifting belt or something that can help support your back. I don't know whether that's helpful, because I was talking to my wife, again, architect and designer, and she's like, there's two choices: modify your environment or modify yourself. And what this boils down to is, I don't know if you're going to be able to modify your environment if you're going to go out into the professional cooking environment. And if you can't modify your environment, then the only thing left is modify yourself. And that could be with supports for your back, or you know, Alton Brown is apparently very tall, and he designed these knives that have like a bend in the handle so that he doesn't have to bring his wrist all the way down to do the chopping. Now, for me, they're goofy because, you know, I'm short. You know, I'm 5'10", and so regular knives work great. But, you know, I don't know whether she's tried these knives with the bend in the handle that are designed specifically for tall people and to make up for the difference in height and countertops. So it's an interesting question. I don't have a resolution. What do you think, Sazi?
I told you about the other part where we knew the guy who was really tiny.
Well,
it's the same problem, and he still works in a professional kitchen.
That's easier to modify, I think, though.
How? A stool.
Yeah, or something. But, you know, again, it's a very interesting question, and I wish, you know, I'm going to get in touch with some cooks who are very, very tall, and some cooks who are not so tall, and you know, very untall, and we'll try to figure out what the answer is, because I think it's super interesting. But the long story short, if you're not going to go pro into a professional kitchen, and by the way, I never think any professional kitchen should discriminate against anyone for any reason, obviously. But I'm just saying, like, what can you realistically expect to happen when you go to a kitchen? That's the real question. It's not what they should do. We all know what my stepfather said. Should, you know, I can't get into it because it involves curse. But, like, it's not what they should do. It's what they will do is what you need to worry about. But if you're not in it to go pro, you know, I think a long talk with a cooking school, I'm sure they would like to have her money. So they will make some accommodation. Am I wrong about this? I mean, I don't see it as being that disruptive to the class.
No, she has her own station and everything.
It's not like, you know, she's saying, hey, I need to listen to loud music while I cook, or I can't learn, you know, which would be disruptive to the rest of the class. So, you know, I don't see why they wouldn't. But anyway, hopefully this is helpful, and you've raised definitely an interesting question that I will be thinking more about. I love ergonomics and design, so I'll think more about this problem. And thank you all for listening to Cooking Issues. This week's Cooking Issues brought to you by Whole Foods Market and the Craft Beer Week. Cooking Issues. Thanks so much.
Vicious, vicious vodka. Oh, you did that. Got me on this corner, and I don't know where I'm at.